Hello and welcome into the KE Report. I'm your host, Shad Markowitz, and I'm speaking today with Eric Wetterling, also known as the Hedgeless Horseman, over at CEO.ca and runs thehedgelesshorseman.com, where you can follow along with Eric's analysis and work on the mining stocks in the junior resource sector. Eric, it's always great having you on the show just to discuss what you're doing in your portfolio, what kind of stocks are catching your attention at the moment. And we were chatting before we started recording just about how we both got into this industry. And I think your story is fascinating, and we haven't shared it for a while. And that is that you really spent a long time becoming a professional poker player of sorts and looking at how to analyze risk-adjusted value. And you're doing that when you're playing poker. You're doing that when you're looking at mining stocks and speculating on any investment. Maybe just share your story about how your experience from poker translated over to why you got interested in speculating in the junior mining sector in the first place.
Sure. As you say, I started off playing poker, and it was actually my poker winnings that I had to use to invest in junior miners. And I mean, personally, I think poker is a lot harder than investing because it's like there's no such thing as a paper loss, for example, in poker. I mean, if you lose the hand, that money's gone forever. In actual stocks, it's like people typically equate a paper loss with a permanent loss, and that's why people fear paper loss, as they see them as real for some reason, although it's like, we know that, you know, this is a cyclical sector. I mean, it's only the same stock can trade at $80 per ounce or $10 per ounce. It depends where we are in that cycle. So it's like, if you wait long enough, we're going to get to a high. If you wait long enough from a high, we're going to get to a low. So, I mean, that's kind of a basic thing. That's, you get second chances all the time because it's forever a cyclical sector, which people always forget at the top and at the bottom. It's like, no, this is never going to turn around. But more importantly, I think it's like in poker, every single hand you had to make, you know, guesstimations, like what does the other person have? You know, obviously what you have, what's your odds of winning against that hand, and what's the other person thinking and all that? Because I mean, the market is just a bunch of people that feel and think stuff. And it's like, you know, telling you what they think the hand is worth, aka what the stock is worth right now. And I mean, like in poker, I mean, people, there's a lot of bad players that they don't realize what they're doing. They get emotional, they play bad hands, etc. They want to make a quick buck and they go on tilt and all of that. And it's like, I think it's great to have a poker background personally. I think that's my main asset. I'm not a geologist or a mining engineer, but I actually think that this kind of, you know, rational, objective approach to risk is actually my main tool, I would say. And it's like, I remember, you know, when I started out, it's like, oh, who's this guy, you know, ex-poker player, whatever. It's like, it's totally irrelevant. And then you listen to Peter Lynch, one of the most successful hedge fund managers ever. And he's like, yeah, poker is the game closest to investing. So it's like, do you trust some random dude on the internet or one of the most successful hedge fund managers? So, I mean, my experience backs that up. I mean, otherwise, I don't think I would be, you know, doing well at all. But in a high risk, high reward sector, it's like people typically look for certainties. In poker, it's like there's never any certainties unless you like had a, you don't know, royal flush or whatever. Everything is about how much will you win if things go well? How much will you lose if things go bad? And what are the, you know, estimated probabilities of either happening? Then you come up with a, you know, pot odds, etc. You can have just a 15% chance of success. But in some situations, you should play that hand because, you know, it's a multi-way pot, etc. And sometimes, depending on where you are in a tournament, I mean, some people fold aces because it's not worth, even if they know they have an 83% chance of winning, if they risk not getting into the bubble, aka getting in the money, it's like some people will fold that before the flop. So it's like very situational. What it comes down to is estimating, and especially in a sector like this where you can have quantum leaps, etc. And price is, you know, kind of like how much do you pay to play this hand? And of course, like we talked off mic, if you have a intact exploration story, where it's like the eventual price, whatever it is, you think it's intact. So basically, on the balance of probabilities, you think it has a shot of becoming worth this much. If price goes down, that means that the risk reward goes up, because again, if you lose, you can only lose 100% all the time, but the reward side just keeps increasing. So, I mean, there's stocks that we know in hindsight that's like they could have gone, you know, in hindsight, we know that, hey, at this particular time, the stock traded at whatever. Then there was a flash crash, corona or whatever. It's like the price got hit by 50%. At the top before the flash crash, that might have been a three bagger. But at the bottom of the flash crash, that ended up, from that point, it ended up being a 10 bagger or something. So I mean, the price, the risk reward can change dramatically with price, assuming, again, it's just price that changes, the cost of playing the hand. Because if the reward side is fixed, nothing has really changed. It just means that there's more upside from that point if things work out the way you hope it will. So, I mean, if you have that mindset, which I came into this sector having, basically, that's why I started buying cheap right off the bat. I mean, I was entered the sector during the 2015-16 crash, and I came in late, obviously. I wasn't in from 2012, but I knew, you know, instinctively what to do when it got cheaper, because I was just thinking, hey, the future reward is going up here. And I know the sector is cyclical, that much I already knew. So I'm just going to be making more and more money with every new dry powder I deploy at lower levels. And lo and behold, it's like things changed and, you know, the portfolio went up 500% from the bottom.
Eric, I think that's such a powerful point you're making, because that's been my experience too, having been in the sector for over a dozen years and having been investing for about two decades, is so few investors look at pullbacks and corrective periods in quality companies where there's already a compelling risk reward scenario and realize, hey, as this thing sells off by 30% or 50%, your rewards to the upside are growing exponentially. It's not a one-to-one return, but it's actually an exponential return. Like you're saying, it could turn from a three bagger into a 10 bagger after a correction like that, because you're buying at such an extreme level that it's easier for it to double and then double again and double again from such a lower level, especially if you've done some due diligence and you feel like the risk reward was already there. Could you give us an example of maybe a stock that you got into early and it has turned out to be a winner, but you were able to look at the risk reward in an early stage and then say, hey, this is worth playing this hand?
I mean, I think a good example would be Snowline. I don't remember what it was trading at the time, but I think like $1 or $2 or something. I wrote that up because they had a few holes into the valley target. And based on what we know from these types of deposits, like Fort Knox, etc., it's like I remember Quinton saying, hey, if you take a spoon from a bowl of soup, you're going to know what the rest of the soup tastes like, pretty much, because it's a disseminated target, etc. So my thinking there was like, I think it was trading for like, I don't know, 150, 200 million or something. It's like blue sky scenario, given the outline of the intrusion there at the valley. It's like, yeah, I could make a case that the blue sky potential could be like 40 million ounces. And I thought that, okay, some people believe that, hey, you absolutely need the blue sky scenario. So, I mean, that was regarded as silly. It's like, oh, it's never going to be 40 million ounces. But that's not the point. That's the blue sky scenario. And in my article, I had my base case was like, I think there's a high probability of this reaching around, you know, 8 to 10 million ounces. And that would be enough to have this as a company maker. So it's like, when you have cases like that where there's like, it looks to be probable upside given how those kind of deposits, you know, how they behave, let's say, disseminated systems, and you get those early, you know, good results early on, which we know from the Kennerland study, et cetera. I mean, it says something when your early results are good. Either you're extremely lucky or it's a very robust target. So all that context combined, and then you have like, again, the absolute blue sky target where it's like, yeah, it could be worth billions. But it's, if you have a high probability that it would reach a critical threshold that, hey, even in a remote area like this could be a success. So if you think there's like, I don't know, 80% chance that they will have critical success, and then you have a blue sky potential that goes anywhere from like, you know, let's say they reach critical success and you think, hey, there's 80% probability of 100% upside. And then you have an open-ended blue sky on top of that. That's like, yeah, this could be theoretically like, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 billion, which you're not even paying for because it's not even pricing in the, you know, any sort of good chance of it having even critical success to start with. That combination and that they have a huge pipeline of projects and the Jupiter Discovery, etc. That just, when I distill that to a risk reward scenario, that's like, this is one of the best risk reward bets I've seen, even though, yes, it's technically a high risk, high reward situation because there's unanswered questions and they were only a few drill holes in. So it's like, yes, we know that it, you know, it's up from that level. Blue Sky didn't materialize. But one point on that is like, even if you make money on a story, it's like, there's no guarantee that you made a, that was a good buy. Nobody knows the exact odds of anything. So we can just, theory comes before practice. I think I had used sound theory and now I got a reward for it. I wished it would have been an even bigger reward already, but it's like, that's the only thing we can do because nobody knows the future. So all we can do is use the most common sense theory we can and then let the, you know, chips fall where they may. If we on average have had sound risk reward theories or strategies, in the end, in 10 years, you're probably going to be up a lot in your portfolio because one case doesn't say much at all. It might have been that Snowland was a sell, but I got lucky. It's like nobody knows. I just think that made sense.
Well, Eric, it's funny you bring that up because I was just thinking there's probably people listening to this interview or have listened to you or I talk in the past and probably think, oh, you just got lucky on that one. But getting lucky is part of investing because you don't know what's going to be under the surface. You don't know what they're going to hit. So luck definitely does play a factor. But when you're talking about theory crafting, when you're talking about using statistics, when you're looking at risk reward opportunity, when you're analyzing it and coming out with, do I want to play this hand or not? There's a lot of analysis that goes into that. It's not just purely luck because you played the hand. And then again, when you see drill results come in early, as you mentioned, like the Kennerland study, and you have a lot of hits early on, like you say, either they're incredibly lucky or this is a robust system. So the odds are actually getting more in your favor if it's a robust system and you factor that in. Can you maybe give us an example of one that you're looking at right now where maybe it's not obvious yet? There may still be some luck in it, but there also is some theory that you're putting into how you're analyzing the current setup and whether you want to press your bet or not.
Sure. I mean, one that is kind of similar to Snowland actually is Condor Resources. I wrote this company up 3 years ago now, almost 3 years, as one of the most interesting exploration plays out there based off their Pucamayo target. I didn't know it at the time, but it would take 3 years until this very week, until they got access permit or got an okay from the local communities to actually drill. They already had drill permits, but it took 3 years to until this week and they announced that they got a go ahead. So I expect, I mean, they talked about planning to have a rig on site, I think late June, early July. So that's one, again, kind of similar to Snowline because it's a high sulfidation epithermal system. So they tend to be disseminated. And you have context. You have a nice geophysical anomaly right under where there's like right smack in the middle of this geophysical anomaly. There's a ledge where the mineralization appears to be outcropping. And that outcrop, I think it runs over some 400 meters or something, which is not bad at all. And the channel samples, et cetera, they run around 1 gram per ton gold and like 100 to 200 grams per ton silver. So it's like the context is that it looks like a high sulfidation system, or, you know, probably is. You have good grades, and it's running right over in the middle of a geophysical anomaly that suggests it's a silicified and oxidized system at depth. So you have kind of like Snowland, where you have the outline of the intrusion. Here you have the geophysics that's corroborating one story, and you have a slice, what appears to be going through the system, where you actually have grade. So it's kind of an outcropping disseminated ore body. And it's like, if that thing proves to be as good as it looks, I mean, you can do some calculations. It's like, I come up with pretty good numbers, like up to 8 million ounces plus Blue Sky. It's like, we don't know yet, but Blue Sky. So I just did, you know, a calculation, which I think is conservative, that if there's a 20% chance of this Pucamayo target proving to be at least a $500 million deposit, and there's an 80% chance of total technical failure at Pucamayo, and the shares go down to 12.5 cents, which is like a 70% drop from here. Still, the risk-adjusted value with a 20% chance of reaching $500 million and an 80% chance of total failure, the risk-adjusted value on that bet is 89 cents per share. I think it's trading at 31 cents. So I've been buying, you know, I started buying immediately after the news release. So it's like, I think that's a conservative estimate, in my opinion. So if it's a no-brainer to me from a risk-reward basis on conservative estimates, that's a very good sign. But again, it's like, this might be one of the best high-risk, high-reward bets out there. But that can also mean that there's a big chance of total technical failure. So it's like, a good bet doesn't mean a guaranteed win. It just means that if it becomes a win from this price, you'll get more than compensated for the guesstimated risk you're taking. So it's like, I would never be all in, even if this was the hands down absolute best risk reward play ever, because it's like a permanent loss in an endeavor like compounding, which investing is, that's hugely detrimental. So my thinking is like, even if, let's say, I have a 5% position, and if I risk it going down 67%, so you're losing 3%. But if half of Blue Sky materializes, or Blue Sky, I mean, that could materially impact your portfolio in a positive way. So it's like, I'm thinking from the end, you know, how much regret will I have if it goes south? Can I live with that pain? Yes, okay, 3% to the, you know, hit to the portfolio, not the big deal, but it also has a fair shot of actually having a material boost to the portfolio. So again, from just a numbers game, I think it's, to me, it comes down to a extremely attractive high risk, high reward bet. But I just want to make that point. It's like, a good bet does not mean a guaranteed win. It's just that the reward side more than compensates for the perhaps, you know, huge risk.
Well, Eric, we'll wrap it up there, but I appreciate you breaking down how you look at risk-adjusted value and the odds. And again, I think that's a lot more than just luck when you put that kind of analysis on it. I think you just made a great point that a good bet does not mean a guaranteed win. It's just the risk reward is in your favor, so it's fine to take a portion to speculate with. And again, you also mentioned there's an 80% chance of failure. So it's not a guarantee in any stretch, but when you're looking at the junior mining stocks, especially in the exploration space, you're taking into account the team, the project, the geology. And while you may not be a geologist, what are the odds of success? And what would it do to the share price if it was just partially successful, or if some of this Blue Sky gets factored in? And if you can factor in a 3-bagger or a 5-bagger from a certain lay of the land, it's worth taking a punt on. There's other times where even if it looks interesting, maybe the risk reward's just not there, and it's not worth taking a huge capital risk, or maybe just taking a very tiny capital risk. So I think these are important things for investors to think about when they look at how they invest versus just taking somebody's opinion on a hot tip or hoping you get lucky because you know somebody on the management team. I think it's a lot more important to look at what is the risk reward in the bet you are taking, what bet are you taking, and what is your exit strategy. So appreciate you sharing those thoughts with us, Eric. If people like getting Eric's thoughts and some of the research he does on companies in the junior resource space, definitely click on the link below. It takes you over to the headlesshorseman.com. And Eric, until next week, looking forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Shad, and the same. And remember, it's like high risk, high reward stuff. Don't bet the farm on any of these ones. Diversify away the company risk, let's say, and consider me biased because I own shares of both companies.